We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to our EdFocus Friday presentation today. We're going to talk about creating a roadmap for making the best decisions with your ARP funding. And Julie Evans, CEO Project Tomorrow, thank you so much for organizing this presentation, Julie. As I was saying you a little earlier, you kicked off the opening of our summit in February. And this is great to have a panel with Stephanie Casperson from San Marcos Unified School District and Ben Maynard from the Kentucky Department of Education. Thank you both for joining us today. All right. So, Julie, it has really been a pleasure to work with you on any number of presentations over the past few years. We always love it when you come on and share what you've learned with Project Tomorrow. And the fact that you've been collecting data, you know, all along so that you can, you know, give us some information about what things look like before and what they look like now. I just think that's so, so valuable. And you always bring amazing guests. So Ben and Stephanie, we are really happy to have you here today. So I'm going to let you take it over, Julie.
Thanks so much, Lisa. It's great to be here with everybody. So we are going to be talking about how to make the very best decisions with your American Rescue Plan and ESSER funding. And to start off with, I want to thank EdWeb for hosting this for us, and also, of course, to thank Stephanie and Ben. You're going to get to meet them and know them a little bit more here today, and everybody that's here with us as well. It's great to have this interest in this topic. So we're going to start off with talking about, so why do we need a roadmap even to get started here? And then share with you five big questions that we believe every superintendent and school board member should be asking right now. Now, we're going to give you some insights into how to answer some of those questions from a data standpoint. And as I mentioned, I'm so thrilled to have my good friends Stephanie and Ben here with us to provide their firsthand insights. So a little bit more about Stephanie and Ben. Stephanie is the Director of Technology in San Marcos Unified School District, which is in San Diego County. San Marcos Unified School District has been a longstanding participant in Speak Up. And so Stephanie and I have had the opportunity to collaborate many times, looking at data, thinking about data. We even did a little video together earlier this year. So having you here, Stephanie. And then Ben and I are longtime collaborators or problem solvers together, schemers even, with a cohort of districts in Kentucky that have participated in our research over the last couple of years as well. And so it's great having you here also, Ben. So a little bit about Project Tomorrow, folks, just in case you're not familiar. We are a national education nonprofit group. We're really focused in on new learning models, in particular, the use of technology to support different types of learning experiences for students and potentially to enhance teacher effectiveness. We're best well known for the Speak Up Research Project, and that's the data I'm going to be sharing with you today. But in addition to that, we also do a series of evaluation and efficacy studies and are also engaged in professional learning experiences for teachers as well as leaders. So Speak Up is an annual research project that we conduct every year where we make a series of online surveys available for any K-12 schools and district that would like to use it to collect feedback from their own stakeholders. This is 100% of free service that we provide to schools and districts, and we give back to all of our participating districts their own locally collected data as well as comparative state and national data. We use the nationally aggregated to create a series of reports and infographics and do fabulous presentations and stimulate conversations such as this. Now, there's lots of things that we have noticed over the past, let's say, 18 months in terms of trends from our research. I'm not going to go through these with you today, but just know that in terms of thinking about this topic around how to make the best decisions around your funding, in terms of whether you want to change the way school works for students today or you want to transform your education ecosystem, we have a lot of research about the views of students and teachers, parents, and administrators on this, and are always happy to share that with you. Now, the thing that I think is really interesting, there's lots of things, of course, that are interesting over the past year or 15 months or so. But I think that as we have been staring so long at the immediate impact of the pandemic, our closed schools, our sudden shift to digital learning, possibly we haven't been paying attention, or our view has been obscured to what some of those opportunities might be to rethink our education systems, to really transform the way we're approaching teaching and learning in our schools. And I think that, of course, as you all know, the funding that's been provided both through the CARES Act from over a year ago, the more recent funding in December, and then the American Rescue Plan really provides a unique opportunity, one of those open doors for us to think about not only addressing some of the challenges and the impact of the pandemic, but also thinking about sustainability of some of these changes. And so that's where we start to think about, well, why do we need a roadmap to do this? Don't we already know what we should be spending this money on? You know, I spend a lot of time talking to school and district leaders all around the country. And what we find is that where there is, on one hand, some really nice silver linings associated with this funding, there's also some challenges. There's a lot of confusion over what the dollars can be spent on. There is anxiety about making sure that the impact of these dollars is going to be meaningful. It involves a lot of decision making at school and district levels. What will be the legacy of all this? And then there's also different perspectives. People all over seem to have their recommendations or suggestions on how school districts should be taking advantage of this money. And it's a little bit like this image, and I don't know if folks have seen this before, but you have many different stakeholders that may have these different perspectives on what the future of education should look like. So just like when we look at this image, some of us might see what looks like a woman in a long dress sort of swishing through leaves. Other folks might see a face that has deep-set eyes, a high forehead, maybe a strong patrician nose. Some of us might see both of these images. Some of us might not see either of these images. That's a little bit about the sort of the inflection point that we're at here in terms of thinking about how to make these best decisions. There are so many different points of view. How do school and district leaders and their supporting industry partners make sense of all of this? How do we understand what is the very best way to leverage these unusual funding opportunities that we have? And so that's where we came up with this idea of five big questions. Now, that's not an exhaustive list. There's probably a lot more questions, but we're going to focus in on these five today. And starting off with the idea of connecting the dots between data and information and that decision making. So really the idea of using that data to make sure that we're making not only the best decisions, but timely decisions, being able to validate what our priorities are within our schools and districts, create effective messaging for our community about those decisions, and also building the capacity and sustainability that we need as part of this conversation. Now, we're going to be using in our conversation today data from our Speak Up research project, and that included data from last school year as well as the current school year. You may have other data that you can access as well, or you might want to participate in Speak Up and be able to use the same type of tools. But let's go ahead and get started with our first question. And this question is an interesting question. It's one that many people are talking about. And it really goes to the heart of what is the purpose or goal of our education institutions? What do we mean by school? What do we mean by learning? What do we mean by student engagement? And there's lots of different ways that answering this question could help you address either your learning recovery and acceleration plans, your summer school plans, maybe some investments in digital learning, or even your social or emotional learning activities. We're going to focus in today just on the student engagement piece of this. And I'd love to have folks give me their feedback in the chat. So prior to remote learning, prior to March 2020, what percentage of students in grades 6 to 12 do you think said that they were engaged in what they were learning in school most of the time? So this is pre-pandemic. So go ahead in the chat, give us what percentage of students you think said that they were engaged most of the time. We'll give you a moment to think about that. We're starting to see some numbers coming up here. Thanks so much for joining in. And as that goes on, I want to share with you what we have learned from students. So this is a question on the Speak Up survey. And what I pulled for you today is data from middle school students and high school students. And we disaggregate into three buckets for you. Before school's closed, so that was the number I asked you to share. You can see 54% of middle school students and 47% of high school students said they were engaged in learning most of the time prior to that. Didn't change very much during school closures last spring, just about the same percentage. And then here is the data, folks, from this year. It's just about the same. When I go back and look even previous to the 2019-20 school year, it's about the same. So whereas many folks would say, oh my gosh, what has happened during the pandemic is that students are not engaged in learning. In fact, sadly, folks, about 50% of our middle school and high school students weren't engaged in learning before and still are not engaged in learning. The difference is we know it now and we can't look away. So we can't put that genie back in the bottle. We actually need to address that. Now, the other thing that's interesting is that for many, many years, and we've been chronicling this in our Speak Up research, educators have told us that the real value of using technology within the learning environment is that the technology engages students in learning. That use of digital tools and resources is a motivating aspect for students. In fact, that is one of those mythologies that we probably need to put away at this point, because what students have been telling us for years is that, in fact, the benefits of using technology is not about engagement, but it's about the better academic outcomes, skill development, and personalizing learning. In fact, engagement or increased motivation doesn't even come into the top 10 for students. So maybe we need to change our mindset here in terms of the way we're thinking about student engagement and the ways that we're thinking about the use of technology to have a more fuller understanding of, at least from the student perspective, what those benefits are. Now, this leads us into the second question for superintendents and school board members. So what learning models and environments are really the best for students, particularly at an individual level? You know, for a long time, we've talked about, well, this is what would be best for the majority of students. But maybe we need to change our frame of reference based on the experiences that we've had to really think about individual students and really put a little bit more meat into this conversation around personalizing the learning process. That can obviously impact your learning and recovery and acceleration planning, as well as your plans for teacher learning, and maybe even establishing some virtual schools. Now here's an interesting set of data for you for your conversations. We asked students this past year, what are the positives, pros, what are the negatives, the cons of your virtual learning experience? I think this data is really interesting to inform decisions you may be making right now about your thoughts around, as I said, summer school, back to school next year, even virtual school. What we find is that students have some really interesting ways that they are thinking about the value of their virtual learning experience, particularly about the personalization of that. I've been doing over the last 2 weeks interviews with high school students. I just finished up my 13th one yesterday afternoon. And several of those students told me that the very best learning experience they've ever had has been during their virtual learning. So whereas many of us may look at it and say it wasn't what the students really needed or wanted, that may be true. But for some students, it was a positive experience. When the students talk about the negative aspects of it, they do understand that for many of their peers, it didn't fit their learning style. And of course, they missed the social aspects of school. However, I think it's important for us to also realize that for many students, that the experience wasn't as interactive and engaging as they would like to have in their regular school day. Now, here's an interesting tidbit for you folks. We also asked students what type of learning experience they would like to have in the future. And what we are finding is that 65% of middle school and high school students, this is from this year, told us they learn best in a face-to-face classroom learning environment. But 17% of these students told us that they learn best now, their realization, in a virtual learning environment. Let me repeat that, 17%. In 2018-19 school year, only 5%, approximately 5% of U.S. students in K-12 across the country were in fully virtual schools. Think about the impact if 17% of students want to be in a full-time virtual environment. What does that mean in terms of the way we're thinking about new learning models? To now is engage Stephanie and Ben in this conversation. I teed it up with a little bit of data here, a little bit of research. I'd love to hear what your thoughts are about students' expectations for having options for virtual learning next year. Now, Ben, I know that you have that perspective from the state of Kentucky. What are you hearing from your school districts? Are they going to address the needs of students that want to address virtual learning?
Julia, I think 100% yes. I think you teed it up well in terms of, you know, this time period has really had superintendents, building leadership, students, parents, like everyone involved in the school community, really kind of reimagining and rethinking what school actually is. And one of the things that seems to come up frequently when I'm talking to building administrators is, you know, the school is not just my building. I think we always kind of thought that, but now all of a sudden the school has become your entire, like, you know, county or district or, you know, whatever it may be. And so, you know, setting up virtual hotspots and engaging community the way they, you know, hadn't done before, but now are finding that, you know, folks are rallying around the school. And so, mm-hmm. But it's also parents and students have found exactly. So your data point is evidence, I think, for some of what's going on in Kentucky, in that I've spoken with probably, it feels like all 109, but we've recently spoken with over 100 of our 171 school districts, and they're all looking at some sort of a virtual option K-12 in order to meet not only some of those data points, but just some of the newfound, you know, I guess, value propositions in some of the blended and virtual and flipped strategies that's been used this year. So absolutely.
That's really interesting, Ben, and great encouragement that your districts are thinking about this and trying to put these sort of plans in place. So now flipping over to Stephanie, so what virtual options are you looking at in terms of offering to your students?
So San Marcos has always had a virtual option for 9 through 12. However, the percentage of our population who has utilized this option is very small. And we are actually using this as an opportunity to expand what I think was a great program to begin with and include more students. And we're looking at expanding that to sixth grade through 12th grade for next year, so that we give the option to middle school students as well who find this to be of interest to them. We've already surveyed parents and have found that there is an interest, a higher interest than in the past. And at the K through fifth grade level, we're looking at some different options, kind of a homeschool possible option, supported by the district with teacher support. That one, again, is, you know, no decisions have been made, but we're surveying about that, seeing if there's interest. One of our local school districts, Poway, has a very successful program, and we've been looking to them as a good model if that's something we end up offering next year.
I love that responsiveness. Go ahead, Stephanie.
I do think that engagement is defined very differently now than it was when it was brick and mortar. As a former principal and teacher, you know, I always felt like teachers thought being engaged meant they were smiling and they were listening and they were happy. And you know, being engaged means you're learning, you know, that you are acquiring new knowledge. Just because there's a smile on your face doesn't mean that you're acquiring new knowledge. And we want kids to have fun, don't get me wrong. And that's why personalizing it is so important. But we really need to be looking at, are they actually actively learning? and gaining new knowledge. And that's, I think, an important thing. And online, it's harder sometimes to see that because assessments aren't necessarily as valid when you're taking an assessment from home. And so that's been a tough thing for our district.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Stephanie. In fact, in putting together and selecting this data, I actually looked at our data on what teachers and principals are saying are the new metrics for evaluating student engagement and learning. And I think we have additional work to do in terms of thinking about that, particularly to help teachers understand how to think differently about student engagement. And you're absolutely right. For a long time, all we did was look at shiny eyes and smiley faces. Well, of course you're engaged. And so different ways to think about that. So I think you're absolutely right. You know, these new conversations around what does engagement really mean? And also, why is engagement important? You know, I think that we have always made that connection between student engagement is a first step to student achievement because it gets students involved in the learning process. But the students themselves tell us that they are actually sometimes more engaged in what they are learning on their own outside of school than what they are learning in school. I think one of the another myth maybe that we should let go by the wayside, our students are not interested in learning. In fact, our students are very interested in learning. They're just not always interested in school or what we are trying.
What we want them to learn.
Right. And so thinking about that is a little bit differently is a great way to get started. Well, let's jump over to our next question of my big five, question number three, which is, so how are you evaluating what works? There's lots of conversation, there has been over the past year, about technology investments. Many districts made huge investments. Maybe they were not one-to-one previously, and they went to one-to-one. They brought in lots of digital content, lots of digital tools that maybe they hadn't used before. But how do we know what really works? And in particular, why is that important for making decisions about future investments, but also about plans for teacher learning and also around what sort of messaging you're going to do out to your community? So here's a little bit of data to help set this conversation. We ask district leaders every year, so what are you looking at in terms of the metrics for evaluating the efficacy of products? And for any of our industry partners that are here for us today, this is probably really valuable data for you in particular. And what we find from school and district leaders is that they're looking for evidence. They're looking for evidence that the use of this product or this resource or the implementation of this model is going to drive student skill development, student academic growth, evidence of student engagement. Also, the idea that it could enhance teacher effectiveness because we know of the connection between teacher effectiveness and student achievement. The other thing that we thought was really interesting is that when asked about the importance of having an independent evaluation by a third party of the efficacy of a product, 95% of school and district administrators said it was important. Almost a third of them said it was very important. There was no differentiation there in our data across grade levels or types of communities. And then as sort of an add-on piece to this, when we ask school principals how they're evaluating the quality of the digital products that they are licensing or asking their districts to acquire for them, 88% of school principals said that when they see that a digital product has an independent third-party evaluation tied to it, that indicates to them that this is a quality product worthy of at least their consideration. So I think that that's really interesting when we think about what works. I'm also, it was one of our key findings, I don't know if you noticed, but this idea of tangible outcomes, really being able to articulate what is the return on investment of our decisions, of our investments, particularly around technology, is one that is of very high interest to many school board members that want to make sure that these funds are used appropriately. Now, next part, which is our question number four, is what do our teachers need to be more effective in meeting the needs of students today? What do they need, both in terms of product as well as in terms of their own professional learning? We also have seen through our data this year, and I know many people have been talking about this, needs to be an increased focus on teachers' own social, emotional well-being and the working conditions of teachers. In fact, principals tell us that they have had to take on a new role as sort of the organizational or their school level cheerleader with their staff, giving them those extra bonus points or motivations to keep going through this difficult time. So I think it's also really interesting to think about what teachers need from a professional learning standpoint. Now, here's another question for our audience. So we just mentioned that question about measuring students' engagement in learning. So what do you think teachers said was the number one way that they are measuring students' engagement in learning when using digital tools? Are they relying upon the ways they've done it in the past, or do they have some new methodologies for understanding that their students are engaged? And again, this goes back to that conversation about do teachers have an accurate understanding of how to engage their students in learning when it is online or when they are using digital tools, or ways to think about this from a different perspective. So as people are thinking about this, I'll go ahead and share with you that, in fact, what we heard was academic performance and outcomes are still primary for many teachers. But they're also looking at things such as number of assignments completed, participation in online discussions, student feedback directly on lessons and activities as well. Yet still, 44% of our teachers continue to rely on eye contact and attentiveness. I know that when my son was in school, he was very good at mastering looking attentive in his face-to-face classes. He was an expert in it. I know, because I was on the receiving end of a lot of that fake attentiveness. And so the idea of thinking beyond that, really thinking about what that means, is something important for our teachers. And that's where we see a little bit over a third of teachers are saying that they do need a different type of professional learning and how to effectively engage with students. That leads me to a key point about what we've heard from teachers about their professional learning needs. And the idea that they still want to receive training on skills. How do I do this? How do I use this product? But they're much more interested in things that are around capacity building. So what are the types of things that could help them differentiate instruction? How could they learn how to engage students more effectively online? How could they utilize some of these tools to facilitate collaborative learning experiences for their students? The other thing that we think is important as you're thinking about your roadmap for using your new funding, your ESSER funding or your ARP funding, is to realize that teachers' professional learning experiences have changed a lot in the past year also, where many teachers have become much more self-directed around their professional learning activities and events, taking more of an active role in their own professional learning. So I think that this is really interesting data. So for example, whereas only 30% of teachers had participated in a webinar such as this in the 2019-20 school year, 51% say that they now have participated as of this year. I know that my friends at EdWeb probably are part of driving those high numbers there. But we also see other experiences. Teachers are more likely to say that they're listening to a podcast for their professional learning. They're likely to have taken an online class, or from a very operational standpoint, found lesson plans on social media or are following experts on Twitter or other types of social media, so that the climate or the environment for supporting teachers' professional learning is different than it was before. And that's something that needs to be taken into account as well as we look at possibly leveraging some of these funds to support teacher professional learning. So back to Stephanie and Ben here. What are you seeing that your teachers need, Stephanie, from a professional learning standpoint today? And I'm going to be thinking about addressing some of that with your new funding.
So what the main thing I see is that just like our students need personalized learning, so do our teachers. It is not one size fits all. It cannot be. As a teacher, you need to know your students personally, as a person, as well as their academic strengths and weaknesses. We need to know our teachers personally. We need to know what they need in order to meet their needs. And that's hard with a school district of, 1,500 teachers. How are we going to meet those needs? Fortunately, companies like Google have been helping us with some of that personalized training at no cost. And I think that's important because, they could be putting their hand out right now and saying, give us more money for us to give you this. But they understand that there is a need. And I look at every company is wanting to give me a free trial right now, knowing that next year I'll buy their product. And I've turned down many of them because I don't want to put too many things out for my teachers and have them try and learn all these different products. And the one question I get back from them is, I don't want to try a new product that's free if you're not going to buy it. So commit to it. And so we're just really having to be pick and choose what are the important things we're going to use and then personalize it for our teachers. And that's the real goal for our department right now is how are we going to do that? And we've done online training for many years in San Marcos through Google Classroom that's personalized and on their own time and paid teachers to attend these online courses. We've shifted more towards the Zoom PD where you can pick and choose which ones you want to go to. We record them and we put them all onto a website. I think we'll probably do a mix of that next year because some people want that self-directed, learn on my own. And some people want somebody there to answer questions and not just be, learning and reading on my own. And so it's just like our students, it's that 17% mm-hmm. that wants the online. And then there's that, 56 or whatever. I don't have the number in front of me, and we have to personalize for our teachers as much as we do for our students.
I love that focus on personalization, Stephanie. We've been doing a project tomorrow. We've been doing research for many years about teachers' readiness for professional learning and how to customize professional learning to meet teachers exactly where they are. So I love to hear that in San Marcos, you've endorsed that same concept. Ben, from a State Department of Education, I know you're involved with lots of different things in terms of supporting not only teachers, but also principals in their professional learning. What are you seeing out there as the major needs that teachers have right now?
So I think much like Stephanie, I think we've discovered over time, I think we always knew that teachers' professional learning need to be personalized. And we even had personalized professional growth planning systems and things, even when I was in the building as a principal. But I don't think we became aware of its importance until now. And I think, I think we made the same mistake we had made with students. If they were in a seat for a 3-hour professional learning event, it equals learning. And so that was not always the case, come to find out. And so one of the pieces that we've been trying to do, you're exactly right. Principals have now recognized that need on a new scale and now trying mm-hmm. to figure out how to be that instructional leader and that coach to do that in a job embedded way. And teachers have become really finicky is the word that comes to mind. So Stephanie, you're right. Like everyone is offering teachers free trials of anything and everything. We're encouraging districts to, I won't call it standardize, but try to use some information, some data to evaluate what selection of tools could maybe meet the need for this. A particular strategy or to be able to show mastery at a standard level. And so that's helping them kind of synthesize to determine this tool's not what I need for this, but this one is, but they also are needing folks around them. So we've had a huge influx of districts hiring what we call digital learning coaches. And so mm-hmm. someone to provide that reflection and feedback and coaching cycles And so districts are utilizing them in a new and different way, and principals are learning to partner with them and use some similar strategies in order to develop all this personalized approach for their teachers.
That's really interesting, Ben. You know, some other speak up data that we have, and I think the audience is probably getting the idea. We have a lot of speak up data. I'm giving you just little snippets of things here today. But when we ask teachers about what they consider the most effective professional learning experiences they've ever had, many of them talk to the one-on-one type of support that they're getting from a coach at the school, whether that's a digital learning coach or an instructional coach. But that sort of job embedded, just in time, I'm working on this lesson, this unit, here are my students, how does this work, is something that they always talk about as being highly effective. And yet, too often, even though we know these things are best, it is still, we sort of fall back to some of that old habits about what professional development used to look like and what do we think about going forward for our teachers. And so it's good to underscore that important role of the coach. As a total aside here to our audience, I just can't help myself. Project Tomorrow is currently implementing a really interesting project in New York City where we have embedded a computational thinking instructional coach within schools in New York City to help elementary teachers learn how to use computational thinking concepts within everyday curriculum. And it is totally focused in on personalizing that for the teacher. And we're seeing some really great results. So we know that these things work. I love the fact that both of you also touched on this concept of product. And Stephanie, what you said, I have heard over and over again since last March. Our well-known industry partners have wanted to altruistically give you product to help, but then also to see how it will work in these new environments. And with the idea, of course, that you would potentially enjoy their products, see the benefit of their products, and want to license that. What advice do you have, either one of you, about how to effectively partner with the education vendors, the industry partners that are out there? What advice do you have for them about what you need right now versus maybe what you need?
Well, I would say from San Marcos' perspective is really looking at where are our gaps first and knowing what's missing before even engaging in a conversation with a vendor. Because if I just, oh, wow, it's shiny, it's new, it looks pretty, let's implement it. You know, no, it needs to meet one of our goals, one of our LCAP goals, you know, one of the goals that we've set as a district. And if it's something that we already have something that's meeting that need, no, that's not a need. Yeah, it meets a need, but we already have something that does that. And so really looking deep down, where are our gaps and filling those gaps. And we have tried a few of the different products that were offered as free free trials, and we are looking at possibly purchasing a few of these because we've found them to be effective. We've looked at the data, we've interviewed students and teachers to see, is this a tool that you see as making a difference for you? Because data right now in the pandemic isn't the same as data was 2 years ago. You know, I could look at the end of the year at my, you know, different reports for my different digital curriculums and see the growth, but I don't have that same feeling right now as to the validity of everything that we're looking at. And so I really think that those student interviews and those teacher interviews of, is it making a difference in your mind, in what you see in your classroom, in the way you see your students interacting with this product. And then a year from now, we will then be able to look a little more carefully at the true data that's, you know, the company gives us to see if we're seeing that growth and reevaluate at that time.
That's really smart. When we design our efficacy studies, we obviously always include teacher feedback and student feedback as a balancing component to not just look specifically at either the data trail or the usage statistics, but actually to bring in the sort of authentic perspectives of the value. So thank you for sharing that. Ben, what are you seeing in Kentucky in terms of some advice or some experiences that might be meaningful for any of our industry partners that are with us today?
I think there are a lot of really awesome tools out there. And Stephen, you said it right. You know, things that are new and shiny that come across can really, can be attractive, depending on how it, it's portrayed. But you're right. They may already have a product that can achieve a similar goal. So I think our administrators find it extremely valuable when anyone they're speaking with from a product, perspective is be as upfront and forthcoming as you can in terms of your goals. And Stephanie, I think you hit it head on is, let's engage in the school like improvement versus the sale, to be 100% honest. Like, what are your goals? How can we help you meet those? And be 100% upfront. It's like, you already have a product that does that, or you don't, or, these are some ways that we can provide more information, to inform those goals. So I think 100%, engaging with the right folks and our teachers, and Stephanie, you may find this as well. Our teachers are not always, informed about, the collection of things that are going on that they have access to in the district. And so I think Kentucky districts are pretty far along in that process, but there are still, gaps in that. And so making sure you may get a teacher to sign on for something that eventually gets shut down at the district. So make sure that you understand who you're working with and the purchasing mechanisms and all of the different validation processes that they have. So trying to engage in multiple points at the district and engage, on a goal level versus a need something new level.
I'd like
smart,
to add
smart advice. Go ahead, Stephanie.
I'd like to add one point to our industry partners is the importance of student privacy. California, we have a student privacy agreement that is used throughout the state through SITE. And whether it's a free product or a paid product, we have to have that signed or we can't use their products. And many of these companies make it very difficult for us to get these signed. And I have to tell a teacher, no, you can't use that. Some high quality products. We're still fighting right now to get one with Khan Academy, which all of our teachers and students use, but we don't have a signed privacy agreement. And it makes it really hard for us as districts to confidently move forward using some of these products when they're not willing to sign off and say that they're going to, protect our students. And especially when you have a statewide document that every district in the state can use for a state as large as California, you sign it once and everybody else piggybacks it. It's not a lot of work. And right. So if our industry partners could really embrace that better, it would mean a lot to all of us.
That's really good advice, Stephanie. I think one of the things that we have learned through the past pandemic and the sudden shift to digital learning is the critical importance of paying attention to student data privacy and really understanding what that means. And California has been on the forefront in terms of implementing mechanisms and processes and legislation that is requiring higher levels of student data privacy. And so that's excellent advice for for any of our industry partners that are here with us. So thank you to both Stephanie and Ben for giving us that that outbound perspective that could help some other folks as well. All right, folks, we're going to move on to our fifth question. Remember, I had five big questions. The first two were really focused in on students. The third one was thinking about products. The fourth one was thinking about teachers. This one is about how are you embracing the new role of parents in the learning process? This one, I think, is really interesting when you start to think about how to use some of this funding, either to address students' social-emotional learning needs, parent engagement and communications, the summer school plans, even your overall plans for thinking about the next school year and maybe some new learning models. This idea of understanding that for parents today, they're in a much different place in understanding the education process for their children than they ever were before. So as I like to talk about when we're looking at our parent data, is that kitchen table perspective that parents have had in many districts over the past year has opened their eyes to the fact that, particularly around the use of technology, it's not just about going to a portal and checking grades, but that it has a much different experience. And so now that parents know that, and my focus groups with parents, it's so cute because they sort of whisper to me, I don't want to give up this transparency. I don't want to necessarily be the co-teacher anymore, but I don't want to give up the transparency and the accountability. So we need to think about how to embrace this parent role. And data helps provide the context for that. And so this is from our, this is from our parent survey from this year. So as we see here, in responding to the question, school has been a positive experience for my child this year. We see that, 46% of parents are agreeing with that, but 36% are not agreeing. Now, that those are general national numbers that need a lot further disaggregation, and the experience may be very different in your own schools and districts. The other one, though, that I think is also equally interesting is the recognition that technology has helped to provide their child with an appropriate learning experience. And in fact, we see 51% of parents nationwide that say that has been true for their child. We also know that in many ways, parents' reflection of what the experience has been for their child has a lot to do with the communication that has been provided by their child's teacher, the school, the district. And so every year we ask parents to comment on their levels of satisfaction. Now, we're going to be doing a lot more disaggregation of this data. I'll have to come back another time to share how this all breaks down by grade levels, by demographics. But generally, we see here that 39% of parents say that they were very satisfied with general information coming from their school districts. Health alerts, 41% said they were very satisfied. School opening and closings, and we know that there was a lot of communication that was done on all the different plans. 46% of parents said they were very satisfied. 25% said they were somewhat satisfied. So strong satisfaction numbers. Yet here we see under teacher-student information, so that's information about individual students, their activities, we're seeing a slightly higher number of parents that were dissatisfied. In many ways, that this is the start of parents wanting more information, more one-on-one communications between their between themselves and their child's teachers, and also between the students themselves. In my focus groups and interviews with students quite often have been talking this year about the fact they've had increased one-on-one, two-way communication with their teachers. And I think it's really interesting from a policy consideration that many of those communications between students and teachers has been facilitated using text messaging. In addition to that, the students tell us that they have become more proficient using email with their teachers. Now, this is going to make several of us chuckle here, but the students have been telling me over and over again this year that one of the tech skills that they have learned how to do this year is how to use email, because they have not been fluent email communicators, and they've had to learn how to do that with their teachers. So there's probably some more room here for progress in terms of thinking about teacher-to-home communications, teacher-to-student communications, teacher-to-parent communications in a two-way environment. So we'll flip this over to Stephanie and Ben. I have one question for you about parents, and then we're going to open it up and see if we have some questions from our audience as well. So what are you thinking about, either from the perspective of your own district or Ben from the state perspective? What could schools and districts do to not just communicate with parents, but really to engage parents in the new learning process with their child's school and teacher?
I'll go ahead and go first. I do think that we need to really make sure our teachers know that it's still okay to hold a parent-teacher conference in Zoom when we get back to school next year. Like, you don't have to pick up the phone you can do a Zoom and see each other and see, you know, I think you get much more of a picture of what's happening with that person when you see their face versus a phone conversation. That not every interaction that is personal like that has to be in person, because parents are at work and parents are busy. Hopefully they'll be back to work in the fall, you know. And I think that if we remind teachers that that's still something that can happen, I think we'll get better relationships between our teachers and our parents. And once you build a positive relationship, it's really easy to have those difficult conversations. I remember as a teacher every year, I always called every family the first week of school at some point to share something positive or something I learned about their child to start with a positive relationship. I attended their sporting events and different things. When I had a situation where I had to share something uncomfortable with a parent, they were fine with hearing it because we had a relationship. And it's hard to do as a teacher in high school with, you know, five periods a day. Therefore, just reaching out and having that few minutes of getting to know the person individually, I think will go a long way. And we never did this before, so it wasn't even an option. We didn't think of it. But I know our parents, our English learners have been more engaged than ever before. They have been attending the ELAC and DLAC meetings that we have via Zoom, and feeling comfortable asking questions that maybe they wouldn't have asked in a large group setting. They feel more comfortable. And when they feel more comfortable, it helps their students feel more comfortable with attending as well. So I hope we continue to have our meetings available for in-person and online. Our board meetings have never been better attended as they have in the last year by having people available to sit at home in their pajamas and, you know, nibble on popcorn while they listen to the school board. And so I hope we continue to embrace these online options. I think it will better engage our parents long term.
Thanks so much. I love that idea of school board meetings, including popcorn. I think that changes the whole dynamics, doesn't it?
Cracker Jacks.
Ben, what do you think about this parent engagement, the role of parents in this conversation?
So I think Stephanie hit on several important points. And I think from a state perspective, and I think of it from an information or evidence, you know, kind of perspective, you know, I think our districts are doing, you know, trying to meet all the needs, you know, by having multiple social media accounts, by utilizing two or three different, you know, video conference tools to try to have those one-on-one conferences or, you know, stream board meetings and those things. But what I'm curious, and I can think of two districts in particular that have partnered with some companies to streamline all of that, put the messaging in one place, and it hits every social media platform and puts it everywhere where you think your parents are. And guardians. But here's the interesting piece. I don't know how much they look into the effectiveness of, you know, our Facebook page and our Twitter account. And should we be using Instagram as a school district? You know, like things like that. Where are people and what information is appropriate for, you know, the different places? And, you know, and that's another important thing. So I think districts would benefit from, you know, they're trying to meet all of the needs, and that's typical of a school district, right? And you try to meet all the needs when you need to really find out what's the most effective way to get certain pieces of information to people. So where do they want things? And I know SpeakUp, I'm not, Julie, you're not paying me to say this, but I know the SpeakUp data does a really great job of doing that. I have handed out a Project Tomorrow report on communication channels to multiple district leaders and school leaders. You're putting all your information here, but none of your parents are there. So now you find yourself doing, you know, double and triple work. So using evidence, using some data to inform your communication practices with your parents would be extremely advisable, I think.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Ben. I think the report that you're referring to, and we do this every year, is looking at the preferences of parents for different types of communication vehicles from their school, from their district, from their teacher. And we disaggregate it based on the age of the parent. And so what we see is that one size does not fit all, that the older parents are very comfortable with going to a school website. The younger parents, millennials and younger, are more interested in having information texted to them or going to some of the other types of social media tools. We continue to see that sort of disaggregation based on age, as well as by community type, by age of child in school. So it's a little bit more nuance than just one size fits all. It's really looking at it across the message type as well as the tool. And I think that's particularly interesting, not only for communications, but how to effectively engage with parents. So we've had so many great questions and conversations that have been having here. We're just about out of time. I think I addressed some of the questions that came up in the Q&A, and the audience has had a wonderful live chat culture going on. I love that. So thank you so very much. So just a few things I want to close up here, Lisa, before we move on. Is a couple different things, folks. I hope you'll come and visit us at tomorrow.org. We have a great number of reports and infographics there that can help inform your decision making. We're going to be codifying these five questions to actual roadmap. So stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, please take advantage of the evidence that we already have to support you. And of course, the Speak Up surveys are open all year long. They're open to every K-12 school and district that would like to use them. We did a special extension this year through August 15th because schools wanted to be able to use our surveys to collect feedback from their stakeholders during summer school. Again, 100% free service. Thank you so very much, Lisa, for hosting this with us. And many thanks.
Thank you.
And Ben, too. Great insights, Stephanie. Yeah,
oh, this was so great. And you covered so many perspectives. And what I love is bringing educators and industry partners together, as we have in the chat here. And the fact that you've talked to, you know, both sides of that. I actually heard you say some things, you know, helpful to the industry that I hadn't really heard before. Like, Stephanie, when you're talking about the privacy agreement, you know, I think we've all been focused a little bit more on, you know, making sure you do understand the district's needs. Thinking of it as the gaps is a great way to think about it. Like what, you know, what's the thing that's missing? And do you have somebody that's already, or something that's already filling that gap? But make sure you're all set up as your organization so that you can close the deal, right? That you can sign the privacy agreement. I thought that was really great. And then I also love that Julia in the chat mentioned the importance of your district website, because Kathy Hurley in one of our earlier Ed Focus Fridays was talking to industry partners about the importance of your website. So I think that's something every organization needs to really, you know, attend to make sure people are finding the information they need quickly and easily there. Julie, I know we're a little short on time, but the question about efficacy. So there was one question about, you know, what does efficacy really mean? And I know you can do a very rigorous, expensive study, you know, if you're a company to prove that. Some of the newer startup organizations, it's going to be harder for them to do it. And I do, you know, appreciate that Stephanie and Ben, you're talking about, there's some of those new shiny objects, you know, could be great, but they're new and they may not have been able to afford the kinds of efficacy studies that a big company could. So, Julie, I know this really, you know, goes into an area of expertise that you have. Any just comments before we go about how companies can address getting that third party, you know, efficacy study? Or if you have assessment embedded into a digital solution, you know, does that help? That yes, it's going to meet a gap and it's got an assessment built in, so we'll know right away if it's working or not. And you just thought maybe you could speak to that a little.
So there's all sorts of different types of efficacy and evaluation studies. And as I said, we've been designing and implementing these for school districts, for nonprofits, for foundations, companies since 2007. And there's all sorts of scale. So yeah, there's the great big huge studies, multiple years, multiple people involved. For the startup companies, we actually work with a lot of startup companies and design small scale efficacy studies that address very particular issues, but also start to give them the types of validation that they need that district and state leaders want to be able to really understand what the impact of their product can be. So there is definitely ways to do it. You don't always have to do the great big giant size study. There's small kind of some rapid response studies, teacher feedback studies. There's all sorts of different ways to do it. I have my contact information here. If anyone is interested in learning more about how we could help with that, I'm always happy to do that. So there is ways to do it, Lisa.
Okay. And that's, I wanted you to speak to that because I knew you would know that and know how to express that to folks. Another question was just on how you get involved in these conversations. And I mean, this idea that 17% of the students really, you know, thought the virtual learning environment was better for them. Is there some way districts and states, you know, are going to be able to work together to figure out how those things can be offered? I mean, Stephanie, the fact that you've always had a virtual option, you know, in your district, you've learned a lot just by having that already. How are you sharing that with, you know, others so that they can benefit from it?
Well, you know, honestly, we haven't really shared it a huge amount within the county. I don't actually oversee the program. There's a principal for the program. We are going to be making some adjustments and changes and improvements to that program. I will say, you know, based on what we've learned over the last, you know, year, it's not going to necessarily look exactly the same next year as it did 2 or 3 years ago. But I do know that other districts in our community, Vista has had a strong online school. Other school districts in our county have in the past. I think it's a common practice in the San Diego County area, and maybe it's through support of our County Office of Education and the Innovation Department with Erin English and their team. Our county has supported us for so long that I think it's just something that we do, but we are certainly going to need to make improvements from what we've learned.
Yeah, or Ben, like in Kentucky, are you going to try to figure out, you know, what models are being used in the state and help share that information?
Absolutely. So we spent some time up front with districts kind of pre-pandemic. We kind of knew where most districts were, but now I think districts have taken kind of stock of what's been working and, you know, the needs of their communities. And so we've actually worked here recently to try to make avenues available for districts to start. You know, they've always had the opportunity in some ways to do their own online virtual program locally at the district level. But we're working with our new commissioner on a way to kind of, I guess, make that process a little easier and to be able to do. And then also, we mentioned this earlier, but, you know, around staffing and things. So it just resource sharing between vetting courses together for quality, but also utilizing maybe a collective pool of teachers to be able to provide those and create what we're calling like hub sites in order to kind of resource share.
Yeah, right.
And so certainly looking into that and responding to districts' needs right now and trying to make some additional resources and avenues available for them.
I think if at any point in time you want to come back and talk about that some more, I think our members would love to hear more about what you're doing with that.
Well, we're certainly, it's going to be a long road, but it's now's the time, right? And so we have a lot of interested folks. We have a lot of the right pieces in place. I think 100% would love to come back and share some of our progress this fall or even into the winter as we start to develop that across the state.
Yeah, Stephanie, you too. It'd be great because I think that's an area where I can imagine people being able to share what they're doing would really, really, really help a lot. So I know we could go longer, but I'm going to just see. Thank you all so much for coming. This really was great. I love that we're doing these sessions on Fridays. If you'd like to listen to the podcast from what we did in February, those are fantastic. The student one I recommend especially. Julie, that one was really good, and it's really great to hear the student's perspective. And then we're going to, in a few weeks, we're going to do an Ed Focus Friday specifically on professional learning. I loved what we talked about on that today. And since we are in that business and doing it all for free, I love to always hear more about how we can do better. But it's going to be on the transformation and funding of pre-K-12 professional learning in the COVID era with Kathy Mickey of Simba Education. Simba in 2020, after the pandemic hit, actually issued a new update of their professional learning market study. And Joyce Whitby from the industry perspective is helping companies to align their solutions with professional learning needs and all beyond as well. We've got some research results that we can share. So please join us for that. And Julie, Ben, and Stephanie, thank you so much. Thank you for joining us on a Friday. It's a great way to end the week.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you so much. What a great conversation.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.